This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with Cameron Kwan Louie, a poet. Welcome, Cameron.
Thanks so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Cameron, during this quarantine, domestic abuse, or intimate partner terrorism, as it is also called, is up worldwide. The project for which you received an Arts Foundation grant, Domestic, is a hybrid poetry, essay, and photographic project exploring how gender-based violence impacts our community. This is a piece about your personal experience and connecting that experience with broader conversations around intimate terrorism. I want to invite you to tell us about Domestic while acknowledging that talking about and listening to conversations about these experiences can be re-traumatizing.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about the project. The goal of Domestic is really to visit and use poetry and photography to investigate these three locations that have been really important in my personal experience. And so those three locations were my family home at the time that my mom decided to take my sister and I and move us into an emergency shelter. The other location is the shelter itself. And the third location was Florence Prison. So just to give a little background on our story, when I was 6 years old, my mother made the really difficult choice to take my sister and I to leave our home here in Tucson and move us into a local emergency shelter for women and children escaping domestic violence. And to be honest, I don't really remember a whole lot about that time period. I was 6 years old. What I do remember is I turned seven while we were in the shelter, and my mom made just the brilliant decision of buying me a Game Boy for that birthday. And so most of my memories are of just sitting in this bunk bed with this pastel green Game Boy and playing Donkey Kong. And so I thought this was like a totally normal experience for most of my life. Like, oh yeah, nobody remembers like their, you know, whole year of between six and seven. And, you know, it's probably really normal if your parents get divorced, you move into an emergency shelter. But as I grew older and I was trying to reconstruct these kind of memories, I was like, oh, what was that really like? Like, what was that place like? And I had this vague memory. There was like a swing set that when we got in, there was some games. There was like a checkerboard that only had red pieces. There was like awful cereal that we had to eat every single day. And that it was a really communal kind of living situation that we were, I think, living in a room with another family. So as an adult, I really kind of built this desire to sort of compare this surreal, imagined, sort of myth-like memory with some kind of reality. Like, what was it like now became a question I became sort of obsessed with. And so I visited all these places, and one of the most notable visits I made was to Florence Prison, where my father was later incarcerated for a separate domestic violence incident. So I just did that really recently. I visited Florence Prison in early spring of this year, just before the stay-at-home orders and the, you know, the pandemic really hit. And I drove out along 79, this beautiful kind of empty highway. There were no other cars. It was just lined with wildflowers the whole way out. Gorgeous day. And when I got into Florence, I sort of found this really interesting community. The prison really is the bulk of what I saw there. Like, as soon as you get into town, it's just these huge chain link fences and barbed wire and guard towers. But there is a community there. Like, there are houses right across the street from the prison. And as you get closer to the prison, you see like a lot of those houses are actually abandoned. So a lot of people have been sort of displaced by the presence of this prison. As soon as I got there, I kind of drove around to the east side of the complex, and I knew that I wanted to take some photographs. I'd brought this kind of dinky little Polaroid camera with me. And so I got out to take a photo. And as soon as I got out and snapped my first shot, these two security guards rolled up in a white truck, and they said, "Hey guy, you know, I'm sorry, this is private property. You can't do that." And luckily, I'd kind of arranged this visit. So I told them, "Hey, you know, I have permission." And they said, okay, go talk to our boss." So I kind of got handed around to a few different uniformed people and eventually got cleared. And so the photos that I was able to take were really interesting. Like, I had never visited a prison before. And there's a certain amount of privilege that goes with being able to say that. Like, there are millions of people in, you know, incarcerated in the United States. For them, that situation is really different. Like, going to a prison may be a very normal part of their lives, but I'd never been. And so I was really surprised to find, like, the prisoners were clearly visible right through the fence. You could see them, like, in their orange jumpsuits. These were probably general population prisoners. So they were walking around a track, or they were playing soccer, or just kind of hanging out. And the facility itself really interested me too, is these sort of domiciles that are made of these corrugated metal half domes. All the buildings were this kind of uniform bluish gray. And the one direction I had been given, the one order, was I had to stay at least 10 feet away from the fence. So I had brought with me this measuring tape. And part of this project is really interrogating my own sort of relationship to control and complicity in systems of violence and privilege. And also thinking about how control is this really sort of unexamined value. It's part of the value system of art. We like art that is in control and that is exercising all of its elements with precision. And so I'd brought this measuring tape with me, and everywhere that I took a photo, I was standing exactly 10 feet away from the fence. So it was a really strange, surreal experience, but so were the other visits that I made too.
How did you feel about envisioning your father in this place?
That was a complicated emotional state. I think going to the imprisoned was important. Like, I'm thinking of Susan Sontag says in On Photography, an essay, she says, like, one of the reasons we take photos is to furnish evidence. And a lot of this project was engaging with photography and going to these places to kind of confirm the reality of it, that these things actually did happen. Memory is just such a slippery, loose thing that there was a sort of empowering feeling to be able to go to this place where I know that my father had to experience some sort of real consequences for not the violence against my family, but similar violence. And at the same time, a real kind of internal conflict with feeling a lot of pity and sadness for the prisoners, because I do have a lot of problems with the prison industrial complex and with the way that incarceration happens in America. And so trying to hold those two ideas in mind was like this real practice in, I think the best way I can put it is like what poets call negative capability. It's a term from John Keats, where he says, you know, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts without any irritable reason, reaching after fact or reason. And that was what I had to do, is like holding these two contradictory feelings and thoughts in mind in this one place.
Cameron, in some ways, your personal history is really entwined with the history of Emerge Center Against Domestic Abuse. Could you talk about the role that this organization played for you and how you've watched Emerge grow over the years? I understand that part of your project involved interviewing the CEO of Emerge.
I kind of came to the decision to speak with Emerge because, like I said, I really wanted to go back and visit the shelter that my family had stayed at. I realized pretty quickly after I reached out to Emerge that that wasn't going to be a possibility for a number of reasons. Very sensibly, Emerge Center Against Domestic Abuse did not want just some random guy showing up to their front door and disturbing all of the residents there, coming in, taking photographs. I'm sure there would be a lot of security issues with that. And so I was trying to really walk the talk of like not needing to control every element of this project. And so instead of really pushing that, no, I got to get in there, I got to take those photos, the same way I couldn't get in and take photos of the interior of the prison, it became a kind of working with those limitations, collaborating with those limitations. And so what came of that was, after I had sort of audaciously just emailed Emerge, hey, like, can I get some photos and can I come interview somebody? They really generously agreed to let me come and meet with their CEO, Ed Mercurio Sacqua. And they also provided me photos of the interior of the shelter rooms that I could work with and manipulate for the project. When I actually did go and interview Ed, I went to Emerge's administrative building. It's just this totally normal, generic office building kind of tucked away in a central neighborhood in Tucson. And I was able to meet with Ed. I asked him, I had a lot of questions. I wanted to know about the history of Emerge. I wanted to know more about what is the situation, the domestic violence situation in Tucson? Like, are there things about our city that are they're unique. And yeah, I didn't even know where to start. And I figured they would be a great resource. And I also really wanted to ask Ed some more personal questions, like trying to confirm or sort of dispel some of the ideas that I'd had about what that experience had been like for my family. We were there in the 90s. And at that time, we were actually staying at Tucson Centers for Women and Children, which since has merged with the Brewster Center to become a merge in, I think, 2008. And that space, that original space that my family was in, is not owned by Emerge anymore. It's probably not in operation. It might not even be a shelter. So that was another compromise, another limitation. There's no ability to go back to that place. But Ed did share with me what their current shelter space is like. And he gave me a lot of details that were really useful in terms of visualizing that space. He shared with me, for instance, that, yeah, I was probably right. There was probably a swing set. They have like a really awesome playground for the kids that when the kids show up, they get a little welcome kit with a teddy bear, that there are games for them to play, and there are specialists who work with the children. But a lot has changed since my family and I were there in the 90s. Like, my mom, when I interviewed her, told me about how when she got there, there was a normal bureaucratic intake stuff, but they really required her to like attend these mandatory counseling sessions and be doing all these, checking all these boxes that they really felt like were the things that people seeking domestic violence resources needed to do. And that's really not the case anymore, according to Ed, that really they have changed their model. They've changed the way that they conceive of what they offer to these people looking for services. And so, you know, Ed was telling me, we want people to tell us what they need and we will meet them where they're at. It sounds like their approach is much more intersectional now too. Like, they're thinking about how gender-based violence and domestic violence is really different for different people, that there's not one universal experience that necessitates one response. And so one story that Ed told me that really stood out was that oftentimes people come and they just need to sleep. Like, they haven't been able to have a safe night's sleep in a really long time. And in the past, we might have said, oh, that mother is not working productively to secure a good financial situation. She should be out looking for jobs so that she can take care of everybody. And that's not always the case. Like, it's so much more nuanced and complex than that. Sometimes people just need a reprieve where they can just get themselves together, gather themselves, step away from that trauma for a minute, and then figure out what comes next. It was also really helpful to have confirmed that it is a really communal living situation in those shelters. And I think that speaks to some, like, the challenges that they're facing now with COVID. Like, running any kind of group facility now is so hard, and they're incurring so many extra costs. And so this is my moment to like make a shameless plug for them, which is like, go to Emerge's website. They have a donate button right on the front homepage. And, you know, you can set up your monthly donation. And this is not like a really sexy, fun topic to talk about. It's not like the comparison that Ed used was, you know, it's not like, oh, feed the puppies. The puppies are so cute. You know, like, oh, it's like, you know, the food bank. Like, we know like a hungry person is like, you know, we can talk about that. But domestic violence is still so taboo. It's so hidden and out of sight and difficult to talk about that it becomes hard to even just have these conversations. I think we have to, and especially we have to right now, because everything that's happening in the world with coronavirus, I mean, it's amplifying all kinds of different problems, but it's really, really amplifying domestic violence. You know, it's setting up a kind of perfect storm. Like, people are isolated, and so they're much more vulnerable. And as men experience these kind of added increased financial pressures, they're much more likely to kind of diminish or to minimize the kind of harm that they do to their partners, be it physical or mental, psychological, as just, I'm sorry, I'm really stressed out, you know? And so we have to be extra vigilant right now, I think.
And I read that just the fact that that whenever families with this dynamic spend more time together, it increases instances of intimate partner terrorism, and that we actually see that over summer time pretty regularly, and that it really, just the fact that families are forced into these spaces where they cannot get away from each other is magnifying the problem.
As hard as these things are to talk about, there are people having these conversations. You know, like I've been reading, I think Leslie Morgan just did an article with Huffington Post that was kind of bringing awareness to this. I know the New York Times has done some reporting on it. And so luckily these conversations are becoming, I think, more visible, but they need to be even more visible.
Absolutely. And that's kind of a major goal of your project, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I think at this point in the project, it's not done, but I really feel like I've learned, well, one thing that I learned from Ed that really stuck with me was how kind of visionary the mission of Emerge is and of people who are trying to work against domestic violence is. And what's so visionary about it is that it's the terms in which they talk about it. It's not just preventing domestic violence. It's not just preventing intimate partner terrorism. It's about ending it. And when I first heard that, when I first heard him say that, it kind of caught me off guard. I was like, is that possible? Like, I didn't know that we were there yet, that we were having that conversation yet. But the more I've kind of thought about it, I understand that we have to aim high because the stakes are high. And the other thing that I really feel like has come from the project at this point is thinking about my family's experience, not necessarily as being like emblematic of domestic violence experiences. Like, it was different for my mother than it was for me. It was different for my sister than it was for my mother. And we were just lucky as a family to get to the point of connecting with services. Like, in her book, No Visible Bruises, Rachel Louise Snyder uses this metaphor of being someone who's experiencing domestic violence is having a bear come at you. And when there's a bear attacking you, your first thought is like, it's not, oh, how can I connect with the Forest Service? Like, how can I get to the nearest ranger station? How can I connect with these resources? No, it's like, it's survival. It's fight, flight, and freeze. And I think that really speaks to the complexity of how we see survivors and people who've experienced these kind of trauma behave. And so that has really stuck with me as well.
I'm really taken by this idea of ending domestic violence and not just preventing it, because I think when we say that our goal is to prevent intimate partner terrorism, it's kind of saying, well, it's inevitable. Intimate partner terrorism is inevitable, and we just have to try to get ahead of it where we can, instead of saying maybe we can actually transform society so that this doesn't happen anymore. Could you talk a little bit more about that path forward? How does Ed see that? How does Emerge mechanize the tools for creating that future?
I think a big part of it is not just intervening in domestic violence where it's happening, but thinking about this as a systemic issue. And this is a place where I kind of get into my own positionality with this conversation, but like, there's no way that we can end domestic violence unless we first kind of look at what Tony Porter calls the man box and the male role belief system and all of these systemic things that cause men to kind of be able to diminish or not take responsibility for these actions. I think to end domestic violence, what it takes is for men to, I don't want to say take the lead, but for men to feel the moral responsibility of their involvement in creating an equal world. Like, I mean, yeah, I'm going to get a little soapboxy, but like in being feminists, in not necessarily like just embracing that title and wearing it around on a pin as a way of kind of doing this sort of virtue signaling, but like figuring out how we can actively be practicing allyship in our day-to-day actions. And one of the things that Ed said was, yes, we need our communities to support us by giving, you know, by giving us financial contributions, but we also just need people to talk about it. And I think that's a great first step. It's a painfully easy first step, is just to be there for one another, to listen to one another. And just, you know, like the first step that Leslie Morgan recommends, that, you know, if you're experiencing gender-based violence or domestic violence, the first step is just tell somebody, you know, and we create a world, a situation where it's easier for people to tell someone if they know that we're willing to have those conversations.
Absolutely. And, you know, in that vein, intimate partner terrorism was definitely a part of my childhood. And it's not something that I talk about a lot. And it's not necessarily because I want to hide it, but because I never feel like it's really an opportune time. It doesn't really seem to be relevant. It just kind of seems to be something so far in the past. But this is a really good reminder for me, too, to bring that up, you know, to bring it out, to bring it into light. I think people avoid talking about it, especially when it's a personal experience, because there's so much victim blaming involved. What did you do to deserve it? Or why did you stay with him anyway? You know, these often are the kind of first knee-jerk reactions when victims try to share their stories. And it's a way that people have of protecting themselves, to say to themselves, you know, even subconsciously, that could never happen to me. Right. But it's a really strong dynamic in all kinds of situations where victimization happens. And I think we all have to kind of check ourselves when we meet somebody's testimonial with incredulity or a type of skepticism or even victim blaming, and realize that that's maybe us psychologically trying to protect ourselves instead of really being willing to sit with the severity of the situation that's being shared with us.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what you're speaking to, and also just the courage and vulnerability that it takes to share about your experience, and also just how common, like you're saying, I mean, really, that Rebecca Solnit calls, you know, it has an essay called "The Longest War," which is just, you know, frames and contextualizes just exactly how common this is. It is its own pandemic.
Cameron, we've touched a little bit on your voice as a male identified voice in this conversation on intimate partner terrorism and the different ways that we can come at this positionality. I want to commend you on your ability to reflect on your own subject position as the artist author in this situation. You're very aware of the strengths and limitations of that positionality. And it's a very complex kind of reflection that you do.
I'm grateful that I have a lot of really honest, really brilliant women in my life. My wife, my mother, my sister, my colleagues who have helped check me along this process. And so I thank each one of them. I've been thinking about, this is one of the hardest questions for this project, and rightfully so. And when I think about my positionality in terms of gender-based violence, and that conversation, I think about it in a few ways. First, I really feel like my role, my job is first and foremost just to amplify the voices of women and children, just acknowledging that I'm not the first or most important of those voices. And so this is a moment where I'd say, like, if you never look at my work, that's great. Like, go read Rachel Louise Snyder, go read Lacey Johnson, go read Leslie Steiner. Like, what they are saying is so important, and it so needs to be heard that I feel like is my first role. The other way I'm thinking about it is just to acknowledge the kind of inherent failure of the project from the get-go. There's a kind of irreconcilable contradiction of choosing to enter this conversation as a straight male voice. And so to the extent that I can, I've tried to link this sort of sense of failure to the aesthetic choices and that I've made, like choosing to use Polaroid as the photography medium, I really was drawn to because it does not create like a perfect image. I didn't want to walk around shooting in 4K and like be like, oh yeah, my perspective on this is like perfect. No, like I want it to be kind of distorted and fractured, and to kind of make it very clear, like I love Polaroids, they're so constrained. You know, it's like 3.024 by 3.108 inches of little image, you know, and you think when you're looking at them just how it didn't develop quite right and how much is outside the frame and just how it really is just such a snapshot. And so I've tried to incorporate that sense of failure into some of the choices that I've made. The other way that I'm thinking about it is just in terms of struggling that I do want to acknowledge the importance of sharing a perspective of being a child who has lived through domestic violence. I think that that is not always a story that gets told. I certainly know other people have taken a crack at it, but I wanted to kind of honor my mother and my sister's stories as well. And as a writer, I'm really uniquely positioned to share those things. And so, like I said before, I feel a kind of moral responsibility to just be the amplifying sort of bullhorn for their stories and their perspectives as well. And all of this just is kind of bringing back to thinking about just that idea of negative capability. There's a lot of contradictions that are inherent in my ideas and my processes as someone who's been impacted by gender-based violence, but also who's complicit in these systemic social processes of control and male violence. And so you just have to sit with that. Like there's no resolution. Those two things just have to exist side by side.
I wanted to make sure that I asked you some questions specific to poetry because you're my first Artist Stories conversation on poetry.
Yay.
Yay. Would you indulge me in talking about how you became a poet and answering the question, what kind of poet are you?
Yeah, I love that question. I'm excited that the poets are coming to Artist Stories. Hopefully it won't be the last one. Tucson is such a great poetry community, and I'm really, really lucky to be a part of it. I guess I became a poet, you know, there's a link, I would say, back to family. Like, my mom instituted sort of with an iron fist family reading nights when I was younger. And so stories and literature and language has always been a part of my life and of my sister's life. I think I was really lucky to grow up in a community of very literate and poetry loving people. And so as a high school student and as an undergrad at the U of A, I got to attend events and poetry readings, like at the Poetry Center and with POG. And so I really got to be immersed in this kind of community and all these visiting poets. And so what really drew me to poetry was just how difficult it is, how kind of vexing it is. I really enjoyed that it was something that I just felt like I would never be done with. In terms of what kind of poet I am, I think that's like the scariest question to get asked as an artist. Like, what kind of poet are you? But it's important. Like, I don't know why it's scary. Maybe it's because if you give an answer, you're like committing to it. You're like, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Today, I think I'm a poet that has been, at least in the past few years, really interested in erasure. And if you don't know, like, about that kind of poetic process of composition, and sometimes just called blackout poetry, it kind of harkens back. I think of it as harkening back to like Burroughs and cut-up poetry and being kind of connected to the avant-garde. But basically what people do when they do erasure is they often take a found text, something that already exists in the world, like a newspaper article or magazine or even something that they wrote themselves, and then they might take a Sharpie and just start blacking it out or some white out or something. And basically what you're left with is a new composition that's made out of what you've subtracted and what's left. And so I've really been drawn to this. I've done like some extended erasures of like pamphlets and just of other found texts. And what really drew me to it was, at first there's this kind of like violence to it. You're like, I'm taking control over this. Like, this is mine now and I get to make it say whatever I want. And I think that's like, that's the first impulse always when people get started with erasure. And you're always entering into a relationship with that thing, right? And so it's not always appropriate to say like, yes, I'm going to take this over. And but people do it in really funny, creative ways too. Like during the Me Too movement, there was a poet who famously shared on Instagram her erasures of the apologies of famous men. And she erased them to sort of communicate the message that she wished they had communicated, and they were often very humorous. But what sustained me with erasure was I really liked the idea of like sharing space with these people and entering into this sort of uncomfortable collaboration with this other voice where they could never be completely gone. Like, I could never completely erase them, and so I'd have to kind of sit with them. That definitely led me to this project, like thinking about maybe not doing an erasure. Like maybe that wasn't appropriate for talking about domestic violence in my family's experience, where so much is already hidden and invisible and concealed. And that is what brought me to photography as being something that I wanted to pair with poetry, as photography is literally an exposure, right? It's a bringing to light of something. And so that really became a kind of guiding principle. I'm a poet who, I guess, likes to collaborate and experiment with other mediums and materials. And I'm a poet who's really grateful for the community of artists in Tucson. We have an awesome, like, noise music community. We have really experimental writers, and we have a lot of really incredible people working in every medium.
For perhaps the young emergent poet who doesn't know how to get connected to a community, a poetry community, what would you suggest for them?
That's a great question. I would say it takes a little courage and it's a little uncomfortable, but going to live readings is what really made me fall in love with poetry. Like hearing it in the air, seeing that people wanted to gather and be together and commune and do this kind of ritual of poetry is still something that that I love. And people want to talk, like people want to meet one another, and it's a chance to kind of rub shoulders with these incredible, brilliant people and meet them and learn about their work. And I've always said, like, the Poetry Center, you know, I loved living in Seattle when I was there, and I love Seattle Arts and Lectures, but those readings were so expensive, and I was a grad student, and I could not afford to go to a lot of them, even with like the discounted tickets or, you know. And Tucson just has the Poetry Center, and we have POG, and they're just like, you know, these really cheap, really free opportunities to connect with poetry. And so that's what I would say to that young poet, is just go to those readings, meet the other poets, and enjoy the ritual.
I did want to ask you one last question, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
So what did your mother think about all this?
That's a great question. I kind of conducted the project in a sort of chronological order of how the experiences had sort of played out. So I went to our family home first on the east side of Tucson, took my photos, wrote my poems. I connected with Emerge, did those photos, those poems, the prison, same thing. And the last thing I did was I interviewed my mom. And it was probably the most difficult part of the entire process. I had sort of safeguarded the entire thing by like doing it largely alone. And because I was looking at spaces, there wasn't always like, it was like there was still some absence. There was that little erasure there. I don't know if I was doing that consciously or subconsciously, but there was a kind of like sometimes missing human element. And that was just not possible to maintain while I was interviewing my mom. Like it was really hard. And we were like, okay, we're going to cry a lot and maybe we'll have to like come back and revisit this. But, you know, as a family, we hadn't ever sat down and talked about these experiences together. We had not like unpacked it. We had erased our own experiences. And so I think it was for her healing. Scary, definitely. I think it was really hard to revisit some of those things, but also maybe a relief just to know that, like, and certainly this isn't finished, and I don't want to end on like a totally redemptive note because that doesn't feel honest with myself, but like it felt good to be able to sit down with my mom and hear her say like, oh, I feel so much guilt and I feel shame about like, I don't feel like a good mom, you know, like I put my kids through these situations, and to be able to just tell her like, nah, it's okay. Like I'm all right. Linda's all right. You know, the story's not over, but in terms of people who have lived through domestic violence, like we get to have a lot. We're very, very lucky, and that we've been able to keep our relationships as healthy as they are is something that I'm really grateful for.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Cameron.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you so much, Eva.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County.